Hi, everyone. Welcome to Type Talks. Today we have Michael Pierce again, and today we will be talking about his wonderful book called Motes and Beams, and we will be going through some of the points within here. So if you were planning on purchasing it, you can kind of figure out what the general gist is about. And this is kind of like a song preview when you go on Apple and you just try listening to a song before you purchase its album and stuff like that. And so Michael has been in the type space for a very long time. He's a veteran in the type sphere, and his videos on the 16 types have laid a groundwork for a lot of people's understanding of how the types are. And they have been really helpful for a lot of people in the type space. I know that Michael's videos are some of the first ones that I've come across in my type journey. And so they were some of the most quality videos that I have actually watched. You were one of the quality content creators of the early MBTI times. You helped pioneer good content. And so, yeah, you get glowing reviews all around. And so, Michael, I'm wondering about if you could tell us a bit about you as a person.
Sure.
Yeah.
we'll make this casual. That's actually extremely gratifying here. It's always very gratifying when I hear people say things along those lines, because that was my hope, was to provide. I remember looking around at the different videos and things that were available. I guess this would have been like 7 or 8 years ago now. Over seven, because I've been working. I was working on the book for at least 7 years. Yeah, I think, do I say that on the back? No, I don't think I say it on the back, but I'm pretty sure that I was sitting down every night typing away at it, but it had begun as an official project. And then was 7 years from that point to my publishing when I actually counted it up. Maybe it's like 6 years or something, but I'm pretty sure it's seven. I recorded that someplace. But in any case, so it would have been even before that, because I think I first took the MBTI test way back in 2013. So that would be, I'm good at MBTI, I'm not good at math. So it's 2022 right now. So that would be 9 years ago, I think. People in the audience are probably like, oh my gosh, he can't do basic addition or subtraction. But anyway, I remember watching the videos and things at that time and feeling, I just wasn't very satisfied. And so eventually I just started making my own content and here we are. But, there was a long period when I remember, even when the videos were taking off, I still didn't feel like it was necessarily having an impact. And now a few years later, I mean, it's kind of like, I guess people really look up to me, which is kind of, I haven't been producing as many videos lately. So that's very gratifying knowing that it definitely has had an influence. So I hope it's been a good influence. I know people will tell me so. I've done my very best. Part of the reason for me, I was trying to codify my thoughts in the book to try to set them down in a more final form. And I know that there's editing that probably could be done in the future, but anyway, those are my initial thoughts.
That's really awesome. You're quite the legend in the type sphere.
I've gotten that impression. I'm not naive to that anymore.
But yeah. Your videos are immortalized, or your presence is immortalized.
Oh my goodness gracious.
I'm sorry.
You're good. Well, I know this. You know, I see people recommending them. It's really, really cool. It's weird, right? Because it's like classic kind of parasocial relationship stuff, right? Where I know that there are people who probably know my videos better than I know them anymore, because I made them a while ago and I've been continued to, you know, they were like thoughts that I had there, but then people have grabbed them and have listened to them more times. And so it's kind of surreal how I'll go back and like, I'll listen to my voice and people will tell me that they really like my voice. Some people really don't like my voice, and I'll listen to myself and be like, oh my gosh, I sympathize so much with the people who don't like my voice. Don't like it. Like that sort of thing where it's like, I don't have the same relation to my work that, people who have really enjoyed it do. And it's really interesting because going back, and I remember there was one point where I was like, why? I guess I was feeling kind of down on myself or something. I was like, why do people like this? I don't know if this is really as good as people say it is. I remember listening to it and realizing that there was stuff in the way I had presented the material. I was able to realize what it was. Well, there's a whole lot that people were grabbing onto, but I realized that there were things that had sort of come out, I guess you could say, in inspiration in a very unintentional sense, into the videos that I had done, and people were grabbing a hold of that. And so I was able to feel just sort of thankful that I was able to be a channel for something that it was me, because it was through my peculiar way of putting things. But I do think that a lot of the success, particularly of the type videos, is not entirely due to me, Michael Pierce. I mean, I guess it is, but like I was sort of played like an instrument, I almost want to say. I don't know if this is making sense, but I'm trying to be humble about it I hope I'm not sounding like I'm detracting from the videos.
Well, your videos are your heart's labor, and so is this book, and so yes. We shall get to it. And so there are quite a few interesting additions you have to the type sphere from this book. You actually talk about quadras.
Yeah.
And you group types by functions in it. And I think it's pretty interesting. And I'd love to go through it with you. So you call them the totally going to pronounce these wrong.
No, you're fine. I can pronounce them for you. I can be like, oh yes, I know what you're referring to. The monarchic, the theocratic, the anarchist, and the democratic, right?
Heck yes. Yeah. Would you like to tell everyone about those groupings? And
boy, howdy, can I ever. No, yeah. Yeah. So as people who are a little more familiar with typology, they will know that these are Socionics quadras, which, as I have told several people, I do say that I came up with it independently and then found out later as I studied more of Socionics that, oh, that was their weird, grouping of the types that didn't make any sense to me. I just had to figure it out for myself and then realize they'd done it before me and better. But I did come up with it on my own. But anyway, the book is meant to be, the way I've always tried to present typology is in this very almost deductive manner, where you build from foundational definitions and then you build your way up, because that's just how I understand things. And so even from the very first videos that I put out, the lessons on Jungian typology, that's what I was trying to do. And I actually follow that same basic pattern. When I made those first videos, the lessons in Jungian typology, I started with extroversion, introversion, and then I built my way up to the four functions and then the eight functions. And then I did the original 16 type videos. And that's basically what I do here with some digressions. One of the concepts that is particularly important to the book is the distinction between the terms I use are contextual and universal. And I relate them to sort of yin and yang. And, you know, I tap into that whole tradition of the complementary opposites with it. But I use... this is a whole lot of different things to cover. Sorry, I feel very disorganized. But... if you take the different functions, you can arrange them into function axes, and you can code them as being more contextual or more universal. And you can then take those dichotomies and mix them together and come up with the four quadras. So to put it in a nutshell, the contextual axes or functions, we'll say they're more individualistic. That's the simplest way of putting it. It's more complicated than that. Whereas the universalist has a more collectivist mentality. But again, more complicated than that. And then if you mix them together, you have the two sort of pure types, not as a moral judgment, but just as the way they're structured, that you have the types that have the two collectivist axes, and then the types that have the two individualist or contextualist axes. And then you have the two sort of hybrid types that are in the middle. The theocratic and the anarchists are the hybrids, and the monarchists and the democrats are the pure types. I'm guessing, though, that you wanted me to skip more straight into just the descriptions of these different things and not maybe so much the structure.
Whatever is totally fine with me. I find that people may not know what types are grouped in those groupings. So
that's okay.
What I want to share as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm sorry if this is sort of sloppy on my part. I feel like you'll have to do maybe a lot of editing on this. Or you can leave this stuff in. I go by, just as a side note, I try to go by the policy of, if I'm going to be saying things, particularly in a public sphere, then I need to be okay with whatever I say being out there forever. I'm not going to rely on other people to make me look good. So if I act the fool, then that's why I insist on I'm never taking down videos of mine, even if later I'm like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best. I'm like, no, I'm going to leave it up because I don't want to be doing kind of a 1984 revision of history. I understand why other people do that. But anyway, in answer to your question, the monarchic types would be the SFPs and the NTJs. So they have the functions of SENI and TEFI. So it's those two axes. SENI kind of get grouped together, and then TEFI get grouped together. They're grouped together because they form complementary opposites, which is a very important part of the book. They sort of form these yin-yang pairs that you have to have one to have the other, and it all mixes together, and it's beautiful. So SFPs and NTJs form their category. I call them the monarchists. I use these sort of vague political metaphors, I insist on this, not because I'm actually making comparisons to political positions. Monarchists are not actually people who support monarchy. It's a metaphor. And the metaphor it's for is this individualist sense, where there's kind of a top-down mentality. They may not express themselves that way, but there is a sense in which they are trying to align everything with this particular contextual vision. I use the imagery of them being people who live up in the mountains, and so they are individual, and they see everything from their point of view. I'm hitting on a lot of different things here, but so those are the monarchic types. The democratic types are the opposite. Those are the NTPs and the SFJs. NTPs are usually sort of confused that I would group them in the democratic types because this is completely fair, because many NTPs do not care for, they speak kind of like the NTJs will sometimes speak, where they will look down on the many masses, and they're very frustrated with the many masses being very illogical. However, when I say democratic, what I mean by that is their functions are FETI and SINE, and those are more universalist axes. And they are much more concerned with aligning themselves with this notion of reason, or a notion of a ruler code that is abstracted from them and is therefore has a kind of separate existence. And they are trying to align themselves with that. Whereas the monarchic types, the SFPs and the NTJs do not like that idea. They have a much more, that's why they're more individualistic. They don't want to have to match everything up with this abstracted, it's difficult to describe, but they don't like that notion. They want to be able to see it and judge it from their own perspective. You think about Nietzsche versus Kant is kind of like the ultimate example, if you're familiar with those philosophers. And then you have the hybrid types. The theocrats are the NFJs and the STPs. They have the monarchic sense of having a singular vision. That's the S-E-N-I. But then they have F-E-T-I. So they have the singular vision, but then their main concern is not trying to get concrete things done per se, but more trying to spread and share that vision in a way that other people can understand. They are trying to universalize a vision. So it's kind of like whoop, like that. And then finally, the anarchists are the NFPs and the STJs, and they are the opposite of the theocrats. They are essentially, they are trying to break up singular visions and trying to help individuate people. So they start from sort of a common ground, and then they try to individuate from there. You see, I'm doing the hand motions so that you know what I mean. Yeah, exactly. Like popcorn popping on the apricot tree. That's a very quick and dirty and probably not terribly convincing rundown for most people of what I'm talking about in the book.
That's really cool. It's really awesome how you group the types by functions, because I think that that is the most honest way to group the typings, because there are more cognitive similarities between these types. And so it makes the most sense to put them into these kind of groupings. Mm-hmm. Another thing very unique about your book is that you start off the type descriptions with the type's dominant function and also their trickster or polar function too.
Yes.
Which is a very unique way of labeling the types. And so I'm wondering about your choice there, what brought you to label it like that? And yeah, tell us the backstory.
Yeah. Well, in some sense, you could, because typically what people do is they do the dominant function and the auxiliary function. Because technically, all you really need to do is, to designate any of them is you could pick any two functions, and as long as you designated where they were in the stack, then you would have the coding for the type. I chose to do the dominant function because that's just kind of obvious. You want to know that. And then I because to kind of keep in the theme of complementary opposites in the book, I was like, well, then I'll choose the function that they tend to have the hardest time with. So you kind of get these two opposite poles for each of the types. And I tried to use that as a guideline in describing each of the individual types in the book. So when I'm, for instance, describing the INFP, I call it the idealist, because I was trying to avoid using the four-letter code, because I was trying to evade some of the stereotypes and things in order to kind of produce a fresher image for people. Which is also a part of why I chose to use the designation of the dominant function and then the trickster function in the parentheses with the big negative sign. But with the idealist, it's F-I and then trickster S-E. And in some sense, that's like it's a very succinct little code for the essential functional notion of what the idealist or the INFP is.
Mm-hmm.
In my approach to it, they are that FI type, which has a difficult relationship with SE, as opposed to the ISFP, which is that FI type, which has a difficult time with NE, as opposed to SE, and and then all the other functions get sort of strung in between. So that was the idea.
I think that it's a really cool way to archetypalize the type.
I don't know if there's a verb for that. Archetypalize? We'll go with that.
Yeah. Michael's book, it reads like a philosophy book. So if you're someone who kind of likes a more sophisticated style of writing, so it's not going to be a straightforward picture book. It's going to be a more intermediate to advanced level reading in typology. So with Michael's book, it has this kind of style of diving into the types in a more philosophical way, where you're understanding them through the lenses of different philosophers or also different lenses of theories. Like Michael talked about yin and yang, that's incorporated too. And so masculine, feminine, you know, there's also fire, water, earth, air. And yes. If you like that style of book, it's also very great for that, because this is a very dense reading.
Oh, okay.
But it's good. It's good because it's very substance-y.
Yes.
I'm creating words to describe your book.
You're good.
So if you want a new perspective on type, it's described in a way that you won't read in other books. So if you want a kind of very nuanced take onto the types, this is a great read. What other things about your book do you think make it a little different than other type books?
Oh, I can certainly answer that question. First of all, I will say, just as a side note on the density, I know full well that it's kind of a dense book. That's how I write in general, is I don't like fluff, and I don't like reading fluff. And sometimes I think this might be a weakness, because people have to read it carefully, and, you know, sometimes that can be obnoxious, but so it is dense. I pack a lot in there. I also make a lot of reference to, so I have my library, my personal library that I've built up over the years. And I would be typing, writing about one of the types, and I just, all kinds of different little things that I've just read over the years, from all these different books that I've picked up from all the classical authors and stuff like this. And I would just remember them and be like, oh, it's kind of like this. And then I have to type out the full passage because it's so beautiful and I'm so excited. So in some sense, one of the things this is, along with being a type book, is this is just me getting a chance to gush. Well, gush isn't the right word, because gush implies I take a long time with it. But it's like I'm gifting people little insights from my library. It's like there's a library of info in there. If you go through the footnotes, you know, and all the references and things, I have a jolly good time being able to reference Rousseau and Kierkegaard and Spinoza and Kant and the Gnostics and the Gospel of Philip. And see, I'm just going through it. And I love all these guys. And I was like, ooh, I get to write a book and I get to reference them. And, but anyway, it can be kind of dense reading. My dear parents, both admitted to me that they only got in like halfway through the first chapter before they're like, we don't know what's going on anymore. They're not familiar with typology in the first place. So it was just like so much information so quickly for them. But anyway, what makes the book different? The most obvious thing is that I have this whole chapter called Feminine versus Masculine, which I understand perfectly well is a very odd chapter that, see, it's all sort of very, I add in stuff with like the yin yang and stuff, and I go on a lot of digressions, a lot of bypaths, because I just couldn't help myself from bringing in everything that I could to demonstrate the patterns of typology on the world and on world literature and on world philosophy, because you can see it everywhere as you get used to thinking. Typology is like a language. It enables you to talk about, and part of the reason it is so popular is it even if it is imperfect, it gives people words, and not just words, but like concepts and signs and symbols that enable them to talk about aspects of human existence that the English language or most other languages right now don't have words to describe these very particular things. And that, I think, is one of the major reasons why people really grab hold of typology. And so I'm trying to show that through showing all these different references so that you can see it's a language that you can use and apply to all kinds of different things. But you have this chapter called Masculine and Feminine where I go on, I can't really explain it. It's something that you just have to read. It was just ideas coming out of me, and I almost feel like I'd be kind of ruining it to try to encapsulate it, because I'm very coy in this chapter. That's maybe the best way of putting it. And maybe that's not the impression people get when they read it, but there's a lot of information in that chapter that may not be immediately apparent. I go on like a whole digression where I start talking about the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. And so far, I think maybe one person has maybe either noticed that, or maybe it's not as coy as I thought it was. But I know that if I read that in my typology book, where someone just goes on like this whole thing analyzing the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner in terms of these concepts, and I'd be like, wasn't this a book about types? That's what I would be asking. But nobody's asked me that. So I don't know if it's not quite as mysterious for people, or if they just don't have the courage to ask, why are you talking about the albatross, Michael, in the typology book? Why are you talking about Lakota mythology in this one section? That's a little more understandable because I'm relating it directly to the typology. But the fact that I talk about the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner is the perfect encapsulation of what makes the book different, I think.
It's really awesome how you tie in all of these ancient pieces of literature into your book. So it's not only a new look at type, it's also honoring the old as well, honoring old texts and the parts of them that have really transformed you in some way. We kind of get to figure out the mosaic of all of the important thoughts in your life that you have come across. And so, Michael, I was wondering, what does Neo-Jungian mean? New Jungian?
Yes, yeah. Neo just means new. You'll hear Neo-Platonism or Neo-Conservatism or Neo-Liberalism, or Neo just means new. So I use the term Neo-Jungian to try to, I am not the one who invented that term. I think Eric Thor was the first one to use it. I don't know that for sure, but I used it in the beginning because I wanted to make sure it was clear that I'm not claiming that I am like a disciple of Jung per se. I am free. I'm free as a bird. So I need the space and liberty to not, this is not a textbook on what Jung thought. This is what Michael Pierce thinks. And if Michael Pierce intersects a great deal with Jung, then that's, you know, that's my problem, I suppose. But that was just my way of trying. I also think that Neo-Jungian is a pretty good description for the type, many aspects of the type community. It's people who have read Jung, are inspired by Jung. I mean, Myers-Briggs in itself could be described as Neo-Jungian, as like you had Jung, you kind of had that original milieu of Jung, and then you still have people who I would describe as more Jungian rather than Neo-Jungian even today. But Neo-Jungian, I don't know, it's just a different flavor to the milieu that I would consider myself more a part of. So that was the point of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like you have Jung's original works, but you're also adding your own twist and your own flavoring to it too.
Yes.
It's like thought leading Jung's work.
Yeah. And I think the notion, it intersects a great deal with Jung and also with the work of Isabel Myers, obviously. But you know, bringing in the socionics notions. Socionics is, I would consider, a very Neo-Jungian thing because it's building off of Jung and adding new things to Jung. I have always felt that the most genuinely original idea is that I propose, not that obviously you can find it in other places, but the specific way that I formulate it, the contextual versus universal, which I talk about in the second chapter. That way of designating the axes, I feel like that is something I can claim to be more original to me, that I feel like, yes, this is a Piercean idea. I am willing to make that claim. I'm not necessarily willing to make that claim elsewhere, because I know the quadras is a socionics thing, and but that the specific formulation of contextual versus universal, I think, which was originally inspired, I should note, by John Barnes, my friend John Barnes. If anybody, he actually made a couple videos recently, so he's back. John Barnes is back again.
He's back.
My discussions with him was what originally created the inception of the context universal idea, which I eventually began linking up with the masculine feminine thing. And that sort of was my entrance into really beginning to understand better some of the ancient archetypes of that you find in the mythological stories. It gave me a language, at least, to be able to fit and categorize what was going on in some of the ancient myths in a way that I hadn't before. So
that's awesome. If I'm looking down, I'm just reading sections of your book.
Oh, you're good. You are good.
The whole video is just going to be me reading your book in front of you.
I don't know what it says about me that I feel like I'd be mostly okay with it. Like, ooh, I get to hear my words read back to me. It's like a mirror. I get to admire myself in the mirror.
So I was wondering about, in your book, you give each of the types a name, and I'm wondering about your reasoning for each of the names for those types.
Yeah, absolutely. I should note, I am not necessarily married to any of these names. I will not die on the hill. I was using them just because it's so helpful to have a little, I wanted a little word, one word that I could use to encapsulate the description that I had given. And if anything, just to serve as a mnemonic for me, so I can more easily recall, I have to reduce things down to a formula, but, to try to run through them quickly, ESFP, I use swashbuckler because I don't think anybody's called them swashbucklers before. And I was trying to. So, in fact, if you link them up with, you have dominant function, trickster function. So ESFP is the SE type. That's why I say it's like a language, is it's like I want to say the SE type, you know, the SE like type, the type that is SE in their way of doing things. To translate it back to normal speech, it's like I feel like I have to use like seven different words to really encapsulate what I've come to associate with SE and the complexity. It's like trying to translate untranslatable words back and forth. But anyway, that's a side note. But with the ESFP, you have the SE that doesn't like TI. So I think the word, a locomotive too powerful to stay on the rails, right? So it's all like slightly exaggerated in order to caricatures, in order for you to be able to see what the salient features are of these people, even if it isn't quite that extreme in most cases. But so swashbuckler, because they're like the adventurer, you know, they want to get out there. They're very energetic, typically, and they're going to go have adventures, get themselves into trouble maybe, but they have big hearts. I'm trying to think of a good example. See, when I had originally wrote this, I actually had not only real life examples, but I list Horatio Nelson, Joseph Smith, Michelangelo as ESFP notion, people who I think exemplify the ESFP type. Horatio Nelson is possibly like the perfect encapsulation. I would argue Joseph Smith is too. He's very controversial, obviously, but Horatio Nelson, like this grand naval admiral who like died in battle, in glorious battle, defending like Britain in the Napoleonic Wars. I don't know the history very well, but I know some of those quotes, and boy, oh boy, is he an ESFP. I'm going to take forever if I go at this pace. So So yeah. You get the idea of where, how I kind of come up with the names, right? So
yeah, you don't have to go through all of them, but okay, if you're more yeah. proud of certain sections of the descriptions, you can explain them.
I'll touch on a couple of them a little more. Alchemist, I think, is a very good one for the INTJ, because that encapsulates what I've even, all the way back, I think, in the very first INTJ video I made, where I was trying to make the point that INTJs are not, what's the right way of putting it? Like Isaac Newton, right? I think I actually, yeah, I list him as an INTJ example there, as sort of like prototypical INTJ. There's this, even if they themselves don't consider themselves mystical, there is this mystical element, which is the NI, and will always be there. So Isaac Newton was very interested in alchemy and these things that we scientists now sort of poo-poo on, but he was very interested in it. He didn't separate it from his work, and that's the advantage, is they're willing to look into that sort of thing, and not necessarily actual alchemical research, but I don't want to say they're not logical, because that's sort of such a loaded phrase, but I think that's the way I originally put it. They're certainly not logical in the TI way, and I was trying to encapsulate that with the alchemist. There's a magician aspect to the INTJ where they will make these leaps of logic. So, Devil's Advocate, I was very proud of that for the ENTP. I think that nicely captures the NE, which is looking for all the different possibilities, but struggles to sort of ground itself in an FI moral center. So not that they're amoral, but there's this peculiar, you get the same thing with ESTPs, but almost even more obviously so, where when you have trickster FI, it's difficult to find the right words for it, but there's more of a tendency to, they're much more willing to, they're more willing to hurt people's feelings is the simplest way of putting it. They don't, and they get very irritated when they feel that people are sort of giving a Sally Sob story, because they don't have that. It's because with all the trickster functions, they are sucking, the trickster function is in one way of describing the trickster function, I think. And I talk about this in chapter 6, where I kind of try to lay out a theory of how the function stacks actually work. But one way of thinking of the trickster function is that it is the result of the personality really wanting to get to know their tertiary function, but it's kind of unconscious. And so they're always seeking that function. And they, as a result of kind of almost being in love or infatuated with their tertiary function, they are even more aggressively against the opposite. So the ENTP, you get the sense where they will unexpectedly will sing the praises of being in a community, and the notion of we need to have, like David Hume is a perfect example, where he's like, our solution to, he spends all a bunch of his philosophical work tearing down all of these things that we think that we know, and saying, well, we can't know that for sure, and what about this, and sort of doing this more typical ENTP thing. And then once he's teared down all of the foundations for like morality as we think of it, he kind of just introduces this notion of, but it's all fine, we can still have morality in society because there is human sympathy. And it's like this magic word that he uses, and it's his tertiary function. And he's like, if we all have sympathy, and it is the opposite of self-love, we should not be individualist, we should be this way. This is a very odd way of just, this is like the cutting board, sorry, but hopefully you see what I'm trying to say. You get a similar thing with INFJs, where they really value TI at the expense of TE. They're not actually super good at TI, no one's super good at their tertiary function, but you will find them. It's very clear in the philosophers, you will find them singing its praises at the direct expense of this other thing, almost as though they wish that that were their dominant function, but they don't actually wish it were that way. So I suppose the other name that I was proud of was the Hierophant, which is the INFJ name that I use, because I think that just fits so perfectly the notion of the Hierophant is the high priest. They're the person in ancient Greece or in some of these ancient societies who would show the holy things. You have the same thing in ancient Hebrew religion, where you have these sacred objects that are kept in the Holy of Holies, and then you have the high priest who is the one who handles them and works with them and then shows them to people and figures out ways to show them. And I think that's how a lot of INFJs feel. So you get the idea.
Those are good names for those types. You give them very mystical namings.
I think someone once said that the names that I give, and this is absolutely accurate, the names are like names you would find in like the Canterbury Tales or like a medieval manuscript or something, where it's like, the Hierophant, you know, the Hierophant's tale, the Knight's tale or something.
Or
I was going for that.
Tarot card.
Oh, yes. Or that. Yes. That's another very good example. Funny you should mention that, but they kind of have that medieval feel to the more archetypal feel, and that's kind of, you know, I was trying to you know, because sometimes the modern, there's nothing wrong with this, the modern names, in going with the theme of me trying to kind of get back to the classics that I love and sort of the classical liberal education that I've received or have given myself. I also think someone once told me that, one of the reasons that they felt that my videos have been so popular, cause I've tried to figure that out, specifically the type videos. Cause, maybe it was just that they were kind of the first of that kind. But I think one of the reasons is that even from the beginning, people got a very distinct sense from them that I was linking all of the different types, ISTJ as well as the INTJ, into ancient history and sort of the nobility of history and of mythology and of these stories, and giving each of them an equally venerable trappings, if you will, in my description. Is like, I am finding, you know, I will quote George Washington for the ISTJ. I will quote some of these venerable sort of almost mythological figures as I'm kind of trying to pull these archetypes forward. And I think people really respond well to that, because that's how people feel at heart. They you know, it's very Jungian in that sense. People sense there is more to them than even they themselves necessarily know, and they will respond to the idea that they do in fact have connections with their ancestors and with the intellects of the past, that it's not just dead stuff. I have come more and more to feel that, as odd as it sounds, I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say social problems. That's a little too ambitious, because you have some things that, but I think a lot of people would find more peace than they would expect learning about their own family history and ancestry. I really do think that, because I've experienced that, because even if you're not related to, like, you know, Thomas Edison or something like this, I don't even know if Thomas Edison had kids. You still have links that go back to those eras. And I think people have become, they don't respect their ancestry, and therefore they don't respect history. They don't even think of themselves as being linked to history. They don't have that kind of, and therefore they don't have charity for past figures. because they don't recognize the family relation there. I'm being a little vague with my wording, but that's just kind of an interesting. I feel that way more and more as I continue to study the past, because I love these guys and I love them, flaws and all. You know, I love to look at the paintings of their life, as it were, that is left behind in their books. And I feel that at the same time, learning about my own personal family history has only strengthened that. And it is connected with sort of, you know, Jung was very big on people having these archetypes in their psyches, almost in, I mean, we would describe it as DNA, but I don't want to start leaping to wild scientific speculation or anything. But we have these patterns in us. We want to be part of something bigger. I don't know. Anyway, I the train petered out right about there. That was just another one of my digressions. That's what the book is like. The book is not nearly even as, I think the book is relatively restrained in comparison to how my mind sometimes thinks, where, you know, I want to go off and start philosophizing on humanity or the human condition or whatever from what I'm talking about. So, but anyway.
Yeah, it is quite the gem. Your book is quite the gem. And so thank you, Michael, for coming out. I think one of the reasons why your type videos are so popular is because they were the first substantial videos being put out. So there were people putting up videos, but they weren't in-depth looks into the types. So you were the first person to actually create portraits yeah. of the types in a way where it felt like you're eating a full course meal rather than junk food.
Because right.
there's a lot of junk food type content out there, but yeah. you stay away from that approach and you like you
yes.
pump in the vitamins in your meals. And so your videos are like very nutrient dense descriptions of the types. And so people are very enamored by the amount of thought, care, and tender loving you put into creating the videos and describing the types. And it just shows in the viewership that you get. You're the man, the myth, the legend.
That's so cool. I've got the beard too to go along with it. Now I'll grow out a big snowy white beard and be the legendary Michael Pierce or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't know that your book is like your life's project. You've been writing it ever since you've been making videos almost.
Yeah. I mean, very soon. When, yeah, basically I think I officially started it right around the same time I started doing the Types Revisited series. I think I had vague notions before then, but, in some sense it is, you can trace it back just to the beginning of me making videos in general, because I mean, that's when I first conceived the notion of how I would lay the information out. So I'm still following that pattern. So yeah, I don't know if I'd consider it my life's work, but it certainly kind of represents my work with the YouTube channel and typology and stuff. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It is your YouTube's work.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so thanks for putting yourself out there and making really, really quality stuff. And thank you, viewers, for watching. I'll see you all in the next video.